Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel. I'm your host. On today's program, Radio and Revolution in Oaxaca, Mexico. A popular uprising is happening in that Mexican state, spurred on by a police attack on striking teachers and the disputed national election this past July. Radio and television have become important tools for the people in their resistance to the neoliberal state and national government. I'm dedicating the entire program to an interview with Nancy Davies and George Salzman, two Americans who have been living in Oaxaca for the last 7 years and witnessing the uprising firsthand. You will want to stay tuned. The state of Oaxaca has been the site of a people's uprising since June 14th, when police staged a pre-dawn raid on a tent city erected by striking teachers. The teachers' strike and occupation of Oaxaca's city central square is an annual occurrence and not normally something that strongly arouses the sympathy of the working class masses. But the government's decision to attack the teachers and destroy their popular unlicensed radio station, Radio Plantón, sparked a popular resistance that was further fueled by the disputed national election on July 2nd. After the election, a Revolutionary People's Assembly, known by the initials APPO, was declared by a diverse cross-section of Oaxacan society. The assembly declared the entire political structure, ruled by the PRI for the last 80 years, to be illegitimate. Commercial and state-run media ignored and minimized the APPO the best it could, while the government attempted to destroy their means of communication. The movement responded by taking over radio and television stations to broadcast what was actually going on in the streets and towns of Oaxaca. Nancy Davies and George Salzman are two Americans who have been living in Oaxaca for the last 7 years. Nancy has filed reports on the situation there for the Narco News Bulletin, and George wrote an article for the August 30th edition of the online magazine Counterpunch. On September 7th, they agreed to talk with me by phone from Oaxaca to explain more about the people's uprising and the importance of media in that struggle.
Oaxaca began its movement before the national election. And when the first repression came down, it was on the part of the governor of Oaxaca, who sent in troops, police, state police, about 3,000. And the police got their asses kicked. The people simply leaped up and said, out you go. And there was a very bloody, messy, horrible fight right in the center of the city. But the people took back the area that they had originally been occupying in a strike, which was a teacher strike. So the teacher strike...
By the way, you should emphasize that this is a long tradition that is occupying the center of the city. It's been going on for a quarter of a century every May. So this is not something, you know, suddenly different and wild.
Okay. So when the police attacked the teachers in the center of the city and the teachers beat back the police, it was sort of like, okay, this is it, folks. And the very next day, there was a civil movement underway to get rid of the governor, to have him thrown out of office or demand that he resign, which he won't, but to get rid of him and to move the entire state in a totally different direction. That happened so fast that Oaxaca had a lead time before the presidential election. During the presidential election, Oaxaca called for a punishment vote. And in Oaxaca, the PRI did not get votes. The PRD got the votes. So Oaxaca went for Andres Manuel López Obrador, and they went for PRD delegates within the state. And this is important because when other states who also suffer, like Oaxaca does, from the neoliberal grind, if you can use that word, saw what was going on in Oaxaca, they began to think what they could do. It was sort of like a confluence of various events. So when George says the military will have to come into Oaxaca, he's exactly right, but they will also have to go into five other states, six other states, because this is, Oaxaca is not alone. This is why the federal government is now tippy-toeing around, because it is not just Oaxaca. It is a broad-based movement in contradiction to what has been going on.
I'd like to just emphasize that the importance of people outside of Mexico being aware of this, because it's not being, so far as I know, it's not being reported in any kind of adequate way, the extent and the civil nature and the nonviolent nature of what's turning into a massive popular struggle in Mexico to change the political system. And that's, I think, very important, because the U.S., if the U.S. people, in particular the United States, know what's going on, I think that may inhibit the United States government from actively backing the capitalist parties, the PRI and the PAN, who are in charge of the federal government and apparently are determined to hold on to that.
Nancy, can you tell me about the day the uprising started?
This uprising started very amazingly with the attack on June 14. George was on his way from Oaxaca to Boston in an airplane, and since I had nothing to do, I went to see the attack. That is, well, I'll put that a little differently. We had to get up early for the taxi. George knew nothing, flew away, and I took my camera and went down to the Zocalo, the center city, to see what was happening.
So when did you go, in the afternoon?
No, I was there at 8 in the morning.
Really?
Yeah, the attack was at before dawn, like 4:30.
Right.
And your taxi came at 6.
Right.
And I was just had to put on my pants and go down. I was down there by 8 with the camera loaded.
How did you know to go down there?
I turned on the radio the minute you went out the door.
Uh-huh.
Just to have, you know...
But the radio...
The radio was announcing it.
No, wait a second. Wait a second.
What?
That troubles me, because from the 22nd of May, when the occupation began,
mm-hmm.
until the very early morning of the 14th...
Of June.
Of June, which was just 3 weeks and one day,
yeah.
During that period, Radio Plantón had been broadcasting. That was the radio,
yes.
Of the encampment. The very, very first thing, as I understand,
yes.
That happened with the attack on that very early morning of the 14th,
mm-hmm.
was that they went in and smashed up the radio and beat up the people.
Yes.
So
how was I getting...
How were you... What radio were you listening to?
I was... I'm not sure I remember anymore. But I think it was Radio Universidad. And this is a very wonderful and exciting thing that happened, which is that there is a public university here, and the students went in and took over the radio station of their university, so that instead of broadcasting rock and roll or whatever kids broadcast these days, they began to broadcast on the side of the uprising. And they began it very soon, and they did a marvelous job until the government came in and destroyed their facilities, which was, what, 4 weeks later?
No. Radio...
Radio Universidad.
I've made my big chart here. Radio Universidad, run by the students.
Yes.
Took over...
Immediately.
Early on the morning of Wednesday morning, the 14th.
Yes.
While the attack was underway.
That's right. That's
and
right.
After Radio Plantón had been destroyed
That's
and was
right.
off the air... And they continued to broadcast for 8 weeks
minus
one day.
Okay.
Almost 8 weeks. They were attacked several times, but unsuccessfully. And finally, on Tuesday, August 8th, that was almost 8 weeks later, three students, who are not students, they call them poros. Those are people who were... basically hired to act as thugs for pay. They had infiltrated the movement, and a diversionary tactic was used. They burned a bus out on the street, outside of the university facility, and those three poros entered and threw sulfuric acid onto the transmitting equipment. So that ended the 8 weeks, almost 8 weeks, of broadcasting by Radio Universidad.
Which is the explanation of how I heard it on the radio live at you know, 6, 7 in the morning they were broadcasting. And that's how I knew. So I went racing down there. The role of the radio has been incredible in all of this. You're talking about a poor state where people's way of communicating is limited. The most common personal communication is a cell phone, and the most common public communication is radio. So people were very dependent on getting their news via the radio. And after the government attacked Radio Universidad, and then the Channel 9 station, which had been captured, as it were, by women, that was the women, the Caceroles, went down and captured the TV station. And
that happened just a week before, or 8 days before, Radio Universidad was put out of commission.
Yes.
On the first day of August, on Tuesday, the women occupied the studios of what had been state radio and television, and they took it over, and they managed to operate that facility until it was attacked on early the morning of the 21st of August. That's what I have reported about that in my paper. So there was an overlap of about a week when the women started broadcasting. Not the women, the station that had been occupied by the women was broadcasting, and that was phenomenal because this is a high-powered operation which had been serving state propaganda purposes all the time. And suddenly, ordinary people were there in the studios telling about their experiences and what they knew. And that was the first time it was being broadcast. It reached the entire state. So people up in the remote mountains who had, who could tune into that radio, powerful FM station. I think they also had an AM, but I'm not certain.
Are you talking about, Channel 9? Channel 9, of course, had its radio stations affiliated.
Uh-huh.
But Channel 9 reaches the whole state.
Right.
I don't know if people in the mountains have TV. I kind of doubt it. But anybody...
I think some of them might.
They have
antennas.
Yep.
And they... So... But this was a phenomenal development because the people's movement, led by the women actually, decided that they were going to take over this public facility and use it for the people's movement. And they did it nonviolently. Well, you can imagine, you see, it's really been a fight for the minds of the people. the people's hearts are with the movement, but a lot of them have to learn more. And the state must have gone berserk to have this giant facility in the hands of this movement.
Yeah, you should have seen they began showing old videos. They showed the video made of the attack on June 14 about 100 times. I mean, they were showing it morning, noon, and night. And then they were showing other marches, other sit-ins, other movie propaganda. They were showing old films about the Russian Revolution, or
really?
The Cuban Revolution, or Che Guevara got a good movie going. I mean, they were filling it up with everything that people had never seen, and it was really, really astonishing. And between the videos, they were having people coming in and talking about what was going on.
Don't forget, Nancy, you told me. Nancy watches it much more ardently than I do, Nancy told me that they even had a documentary of the struggle of the Palestinians in the occupied territories.
Isn't that amazing?
And I thought to myself, my God, you know, these are people living in the mountains, many of them, who hardly know what's going on, you know, 50 kilometers away from them. And here they are hearing about and seeing people struggling, you know, thousands of miles away. And what a, you know, what a phenomenal thing that was.
Well, it was, yes, it was. It was really phenomenal. It was technically a mess. I mean, on the first, I was happened to be right glued to my set when this all happened. And the women, the station went blank, and then I heard on the radio, the women say, we have taken over the Channel 9 facilities, and please send food, and please send water, and please send a technician. Because none of them knew how to operate the actual facilities. And little by little, they got technicians in there who could operate the cameras and the, you know, and the TV video, whatever things they had to do. That was enormously exciting. And when the government cracked down and destroyed the TV station and Radio Universidad, the response of the popular movement was to turn around and capture 10 commercial radio
stations. Wait a minute, Nancy. Radio Universidad was destroyed several weeks earlier.
Yeah.
No. The people turning around and seizing 10 stations happened, if I'm not mistaken, the day after the government destroyed the transmission control room up on
that's
hill.
That's right.
So that was already a full 2 weeks or more after Radio Universidad had been put out of business.
That's right.
I'm sorry, it was almost 2 weeks.
Right.
So that was a response to this destruction of the people's ability to use Channel 9 and the state radio.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just to make that clear.
Okay. So then they turned around and took control, invaded and took control of 10 commercial stations, AM and FM, both. I think there were 6 on the FM and 4 on the AM, like that. And so they sort of said, you know, in your face, man. They, you know, you do it to us, we'll do it to you. But that's how important the radio has become, because the use of the radio has been for people to call in to say they see something bad going on, and the people in the radio station relay that info by telephone, cell phone, to the movement managers, I don't know what you want to call them, the mobile forces that run out and try and, you know, put out the fires when there's an attack. And they use the radio to call for food, to call for people to come in and be on the barricades, for people to donate blood when someone's wife was in the hospital with cancer, and they put out a call for blood donors. They use that radio for every kind of communication imaginable, and it was enormously important.
You're listening to an interview with Nancy Davies and George Salzman, two Americans living in Oaxaca, Mexico. They're telling us about the popular movement happening in that state and how the people are seizing use of the media to further their cause. This program is Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reese-Mandel, and I'm your host. You can check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net for the Media Geek blog containing news and views that don't quite make it onto the weekly program. You can also download the program or get the podcast at radio.mediageek.net. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. We now return to that interview with Nancy Davies and George Salzman.
They had to cut down from the 10 stations that they took to now, they have, are holding on to either three or four, depending on who you ask, simply because there wasn't enough person power. But they have barricaded the streets around the selected stations so that those stations are being held, I would say, to the death. They've got the roads blocked. They have appealed to people to be patient when they can't get through the barricades. They have people bringing food and water, and they're just holding on to those stations, which are, one on the AM dial is a very, get a good grasp of what needs to be done in the way of education. So they have programs explaining to everybody what is neoliberalism, why the Plan Puebla Panama, which is a new development going across the Isthmus of Mexico, why that's a bad thing for the Mexicans, what the people are doing to defend their natural resources and what the capitalists are doing to rip them off. Just education day by day by day by day for people, putting it all together into a big picture of what was happening to Mexico. And to Oaxaca in particular, because Oaxaca has suffered very badly, being a very poor state in income and a rich state in natural resources. And it has been exploited terrifically. And everybody knows what is happening to them and to their neighbor. But what the radio was doing was saying, this, connect this to this, you know, the ankle bone's connected to the leg bone's connected to the knee bone. And that is what was an enormous educational project. And it has been very successful.
And it's ongoing.
I turn on the radio every day. And they are trying to, you know, they are putting out what it's all about in terms of making the connections. And I think that not only here in Oaxaca, but in other states. I mean, the Plan Puebla Panama affects five states, I think four or five.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting it. They're getting the same information. There's going to be the same, you know, sort of popular movement that will take hold, is taking hold in all these states. And I think it's important for people in the U.S. who don't put together, you know, why the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, don't put it together. Here in Mexico, man, they are putting it together.
What is the mood like in Oaxaca right now? On the streets? I mean, is it tense? Is it celebratory? Or is it just sort of, is there a lot of movement? What's it like there right now?
I have a simple answer. All of the above. That's my answer.
Well,
go ahead, George.
Yeah. Now, my sense from walking around is that people are aware that there's a potential threat in the background, but that doesn't seem to affect their behavior. They're camped out. They look very relaxed. You know, they're reading the papers. People are doing, sewing work. They do make decorative towelettes and placemats and so on. And my sense is that there's an enormous feeling, not only that they're in the right, but that they're going to win. And that doesn't mean that they're not aware of the threats of the government. But it doesn't seem to have terrified them adequately to immobilize them. I went down to the big market, you know, to do some shopping, and on the way I was walking along a street which borders this huge plaza. It's called the Plaza de Danza, which faces the municipal government building. There's the municipal police barracks, and the people have locked it up. I mean, when I used to walk there to the market, there's a little opening on the street, and the police cars come in and out all the time. There's someone there who, you know, signals them when to go and holds the pedestrians back in order to let the police vehicles go in and out. That is now closed by a steel gate, and people are sitting outside. I mean, they really have immobilized the instituted government infrastructure. So, of course, it doesn't mean that police aren't elsewhere, and the state has still control of money, and the police are being paid by the state, and the threat of using that force is always in the background. But it doesn't. I don't have the impression that people are really scared.
You've been listening to an interview with Nancy Davies and George Salzman, who've been telling us about the popular uprising in the state of Oaxaca, Mexico, and how the movement has been seizing the media to communicate and educate the people. Leftist presidential candidate Andrés Miguel López Obrador has called for the convening of a National Democratic Convention in order to, quote, form a government that has the legitimacy to reestablish the republic and constitutional order, end quote. That convention is scheduled to happen on September 16th. Around that time, Free Radio activist Stephen Dunifer will be traveling to Oaxaca to bring expertise in microbroadcasting in aid of the People's Movement. You will probably not hear or read in the mainstream American media much news of the popular uprising in Oaxaca or elsewhere in Mexico. There are some sources to turn to on the internet. Narconews.com has carried Nancy Davies' reports, along with other news from Latin America and the front lines of the United States' so-called war on drugs. Counterpunch.org has also continued to carry critical articles about the situation in Mexico. Of course, I will continue to publish updates and links to articles at the Media Geek website, MediaGeek.net, as well as here on this radio program. Mass media, and especially broadcast media, are important tools of communication, especially for reaching people who are geographically dispersed and who aren't necessarily connected to satellite and internet communications. Radio cuts across urban and rural boundaries and across class divisions. People around the world turn to their radios every day to understand their world better. In the internet age, it's easy to take for granted or dismiss this simple medium that's more than 80 years old, but there is still power in the transmitter. That's why I continue to produce this program and support community, grassroots, low power, and pirate radio, wherever it may be. I hope you will too. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at radio.mediageek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at mediageek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowe. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WYQZ in Warrenton-Bealeton, Virginia, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.